Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 21, Tarot, Astrology, and Games in Harry Potter, where we will be studying Harry Potter with the help of our Hogwarts Divination class. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling, I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. What do you think of our topic today, John?
Well, there couldn't be a subject that I'm more excited about than hermetic uses in literature. This is the occult elements in Harry Potter, from alchemy, astrology, tarot, the games playing. This is something that I've been living with since 2000, and there's exciting stuff going on today, as we're going to find out, in all of these studies, especially our guest in Paris.
I'm
very excited. And we bought Beatrice Groves on because she's not excited about these things. She's she's all sobriety, while John is all enthusiasm. So I'm glad you've got this balance going here.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I think J.K. Rowling may be of two minds too. So I'm excited to get into that a little bit on our show today. So without further ado, let me introduce our special guest today, Eglantine Pillet, a PhD student in English literature at the Sorbonne in Paris, where she also received her master's degree in English literature. In both cases, she has focused on Harry Potter. She spent 3 years teaching French at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and before that, she had a career in graphic design and cartoon animation. She is the author of Harry Potter, A Fool and a King, which is on tarot and chess in the Harry Potter stories, which she delivered as a conference paper at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference last October. Welcome to the show, Eglantine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad you could come to us from Paris. How exciting is that?
Very exciting.
All right. I honeymooned in Paris, Eglantine. It was just my dream spot. So I love the city.
I hope it lived up to your expectations.
It absolutely did. And, you know, I didn't have a single bad meal the entire time I was there. Wow, is the food good.
Really.
Also, we are joined today by Beatrice Groves, research fellow in Renaissance English at Oxford University and author of the book Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. And listeners, if you haven't checked that out yet, you should, absolutely should. Lots of wonderful things in there. B is also the author of the blog Batilda's Notebook on MuggleNet, and she has written about some elements of divination, a little bit on tarot as well. Welcome back to the show, B.
Hi, Katie. Lovely to be here.
All right, so let's go right ahead into our first question. Eglantine, I'm just very curious, when did you realize that Harry Potter was literature worth taking seriously?
I really enjoyed reading the books, as everyone did, and it really struck me that there was something more to them when I realized how popular they were, how life-changing they were for people, and how big a concept it had become. And that's when I took my project of studying it to the Sorbonne University in Paris, and it was not super easy to find a supervisor who agreed to study Harry Potter. But when I did, it was wonderful, and he actually took me very seriously, and it just confirmed what I had thought about the books. that there was definitely so much to them.
Yeah. Did you read them in English or were you reading them in French?
I read them in English from the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. And have you since read them in French? I'm just curious about if you see any differences.
Actually, I haven't read them yet, but that's part of my PhD research.
Oh.
Because I will be working on translation as well.
Oh, very interesting. We'll have to have you back
on. Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
I mean, fluency in French, because Rowling is fluent in French, is a part of this. It's like Nabokov studies, he's fluent in French. And so there are a lot of French jokes in Lolita and such that if you don't speak French, you don't get all the C-O-N reference jokes he makes throughout the book. I imagine there are jokes like that in Harry Potter that those of us who, my name is Norman, but I have no French. I'm sure that's a very rich part of the study.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with like the hidden clues in names and spells and everything, some of them really, they're very obvious when you speak French. And they are actually more hidden when you're like not a French speaker or Italian speaker or a Latin language speaker.
Yeah.
Can you give us any examples of things that people who are not Francophone might not have picked up on?
Well, for example, Umbridge, her name is, well, in French, it's quite common to say that you take umbrage from something. I don't think it's quite as common in English as an expression. Oh, or maybe it is.
Yeah, it may be more modern in French than it is in English.
What interests me about that, especially given our topic today, Eglantine, is that this is also a kind of play, right? You talked in your master's thesis about wordplay as well as games, mm-hmm. and that this is a part of how she's, you know, kind of playing with us and giving us little puzzles to figure out. Do you see a connection between those?
Yeah, I guess it's just a very playful series throughout the seven books. And on every layer, on every level, you have those little puzzles and those little games that you have to play to move the story forward. And when you read them again, you discover those new games that you hadn't noticed the first time. So yeah, I guess it all works together just to keep the reader on their toes all the time.
What actually inspired you to do your master's thesis on the games particularly?
So I was doing my research for my first year of master's because we have to write two dissertations here. Mm. And in my first year, I was working on medieval influences. And of course, because there are mentions of tarot and chess, which are both of medieval origin, I looked into those and it seemed to me there was so much more than what was on the surface. It was not just references in the text. It seemed to me that there was a structural element to those games for the story. So that's why for my second year, I wanted to study that further, and I really went and dug through those games in the books.
Oh, yeah. That's great. And I love that, because it's part of how I think J.K. Rowling works, that, you know, she likes engaging in games, and that she likes building puzzles and solving puzzles. And I agree that it's part of the layering that she's doing there. Really cool. All right, so let's get right into tarot. Eglantine, mm-hmm. tell us about the tarot images that she uses, and what should we take away from that in terms of the meaning of the story?
The first tarot image that struck me was when I was looking at the explanation for the tarot card of the Wheel of Fortune. And it's not very obvious in the books that the Wheel of Fortune is there. But when you look at the description of the card, the scene is pretty much an ekphrasis of that card. The scene in the graveyard at the end of the fourth book, when Harry comes face to face with Voldemort for the first time. The description of the card mentions that it's based on the symbolism of the number two. It's two forces opposing each other. And there are two on the tarot card, on the image of the tarot card, there are two snakes in two boats fighting each other, joined one to the other by their masts, and the whole scene is set in motion by a sphinx. So the sphinx was definitely the clicking moment for me, where I thought, oh, that's why there's a sphinx in the maze. It seemed so random at first. And the whole symbolism is definitely there, and the Wheel of Fortune card is a turning point in Tarot. So that's definitely a turning point in the series as well.
Oh, yeah. And John, I mean, I think that fits in with some of the ring structure, doesn't it? To see that moment as the hinge or the turning point?
The fourth book starts off with the reference to the Hanged Man, which is a reference to, well, first of all, he's an upside down four. And so you're in the fourth book, and it's also the turning point of the 22 major arcana trumps. She's playing the tarot cards. She's signaling the structure of the books with the tarot references. She continues with the Hanged Man throughout the series. I just posted about this with Harvard professor about just the Hanged Man references. How many hangings they have? How many people are turned upside down by Leva Corpus? And Neville is hung upside down by his uncle. And if you go through the books and search for hang, you know, dangle or whatever it is, you find a surfeit of references to upside down people. And so that image, like this much more carefully embedded one, the Wheel of Fortune, highlights Rowling's other artistry. You know, it's a clue to the rest of what she's doing.
Yeah, that's really neat. Okay, so we have some, you know, I'm sort of thinking about this, and honestly, I don't know all that much about tarot itself, but maybe we could take a step back. It sounds like we've got two cards now, the Wheel of Fortune card and the Hanged Man. And so the tarot is a set of cards. Is it kind of like playing cards, Eglantine?
So it's kind of like playing cards. It was used for playing in the past. It's mostly seen as a divination tool now.
Yeah.
But so it's, yes, a set of 78 cards divided into parts. Minor Arcana, 56 of them. Major Arcana, 22 of them. The Major Arcana have pictures on them, and Minor Arcana are like playing cards, but usually use different suits than the ones we use in playing cards. Clubs and spades and hearts and diamonds. In Tarot, it's usually the Latin suits that are used. Wands and swords and cups and pentacles.
The history of the Tarot is pretty intense. There's a wonderful book called A Wicked Pack of Cards, The Origins of the Occult Tarot. And a tarot person will tell you that it has its origins in ancient Egypt and such, and it's nonsense. There was a card game in Italy and France in the 14th and 15th centuries. They have the cards. It was never used for divination. It wasn't until really the time of the French Revolution, up to your time, Katie, here for your historical stuff. I mean, this is really a counter-enlightenment. You know, the madness of the romantic reaction to enlightenment excesses that gives us the tarot as a divinatory feature and the legends of the Egyptian past. It's a wonderful history to explore, but it's delusional to think that these things actually have any Egyptian heritage. Like the Hanged Man card is an image that you find in Italy because their car was originally called the Traitor because they hung traitors upside down. It's just an image that people would recognize the way they would justice or judgment or strength, you know, four virtues and such. The sequence and the relationship to the 22 Hebrew letters is essentially projection and fiction.
Or, you know, sort of looking back and trying to add interpretation on top of it.
So you're much more kind than I am, Katie.
when you're doing a tarot reading, you're turning the cards over in a particular order to suggest what your future might be. Is that the idea? I'm just going from movies at this point.
Usually you pull the cards in spreads. The way that Trelawney does it, of course, is she's drunk whenever she's. We only see her doing tarot when she's drunk, so we don't really know what her normal practice was. one time she's using a playing card deck rather than an actual tarot card deck. And another time she's just pulling cards at random. That's when she's pulling the lightning struck tower card, which is the big reference inside the stories to a major arcana card.
So some of the cards have images on them, and I'm guessing those are the ones that, you know, we're sort of focused on. And the Wheel of Fortune card, the imagery there, she's bringing that into that turning point as a kind of a hidden signal. And then John has talked to us a little bit about the Hanged Man. Let's talk. I think, Eglantine, you had talked a little bit about the Hanged Man in your paper as well. Where do you see the Hanged Man coming through? I think you had some things to add to that, to the images, the many images that John has already sort of suggested to us. Where do you see the Hanged Man? Where do we see it in Harry Potter?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Hanged Man is also very closely associated with Snape, who is actually shown hanging upside down in a few memories and with the Levicorpus spell. And also, the Hanged Man is the idea of sacrifice, is related to the idea of sacrifice. So that really works with Snape's sacrifice, eventually allowing Harry to save the world.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I was interested, too, John, that you said that maybe its original name was Traitor. Which that's
right.
Interesting when you think about that in regard to Snape as well.
Exactly, that his sacrifice is tied to the fact that he was a traitor. That's hard to avoid. I agree.
Eglantine, when we see Snape hanging upside down, are there other images of hanged men that we might want to take note of, or the, you know, hanging by the foot imagery?
Well, there's also a hidden reference to hanged men in general in that Hand of Glory that Draco Malfoy finds in that antique shop in one of the earlier books. The Hand of Glory is like the legend of the Hand of Glory is that it was the hand of a man who had been hanged. So it also comes in relation with the Hanged Man card. Hanged men are everywhere in those books.
Yeah.
And also, the students at Hogwarts play a lot of Hangman.
Yeah. I mean, I should note that when he looks at the Hand of Glory, he's doing a little survey of the shop while his father's saying nasty things about him. It's a pretty loaded moment because he sees the Vanishing Cabinet for the first time. He sees the cursed necklace that he'll use in Half-Blood Prince. This is all in Chamber. But he sees a rope right after he sees the Hand of Glory, and Rowling specifies that it's a hangman's rope. Again and again with the hangman thing.
Right.
I mean, when she released the series finale title, she had a game of hangman on her website so that you could, you know, do that. And one of the Weasleys' wizard wheezes is a reusable hangman. Spell it or he'll swing. You know, I mean, it really is everywhere.
And she's layering it so that we can't miss it. And, of course, sacrifice being such a profound overall theme of the books. But how interesting that we also see it in the occult shop, which I think that's wonderful to see all those images there. Now, the other one that we briefly mentioned already is the image of the lightning struck tower. And of course, that's a very important chapter in the Harry Potter series. Eglantine, can you tell us about what that card is like and what's the meaning of the card and then how you think that transfers to Harry Potter?
Yes. So the card of the lightning struck tower is the image of a tower that has been struck by a flash of lightning and it's half destroyed. The lightning struck at the top of the tower, and the symbolism of the top of the tower and the tower is humans and their heads that were struck by lightning. And falling from that tower, there is a king, which is the first character to fall from the tower, and then the architect of the tower then falls as well. And those elements really make you think of Harry, who was, of course, struck by a spell to his head and has a flash of lightning as a scar on his head. And the symbolism of the card is it's related to the Tower of Babel, and how human pride is there is a consequence to human pride, and that's also related to, you know, those seven deadly sins that also have a link with Harry Potter, but definitely the pride element in that card is is there.
With the picture on the card, so in the book it's only ever described as the lightning struck tower. We don't hear anything more about what it looks like, but as Eglantine said, it's got these figures falling from it, and I think that's one of the things you're meant to think about. So obviously that we in that chapter we're going to then have Dumbledore falling from the tower, and that's part of the prophecy of the card, which you have to kind of know the tarot card to realize that.
Yeah, so I mean in some ways it's a literal prediction of what's going to happen to Dumbledore, that Trelawney actually, you know, is kind of going through the cards, I guess, and does that. So I'm interested also in these figures. You know, you said there are two figures who are actually falling, and so it suggests that maybe there's some other person or character who is being affected by the lightning strike as well. The architect?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think of the architect and who made Harry the Tower, if we're assuming that Harry is the tower, Voldemort is the architect of that tower because he was the one who struck Harry with his spell. And eventually both those characters, Dumbledore, who would be like the king figure, and Voldemort, who would be the architect figure, do die. So it does come to a completion.
Yeah. I mean, you could see that maybe as the scene where when Dumbledore dies, this is the beginning of Voldemort's demise as well, maybe.
There's a scene in here where Harry rushes into Dumbledore's office, and Trelawney is there trying to convince him to take her seriously, that he's in danger. And Dumbledore pretty much dismisses her. He's not interested in her prophecies. That's curious, right? I mean, maybe if he had known that he was going off the top of the tower. She is the descendant of a woman named Cassandra, and there's a Cassandra element here, where Cassandra, of course, is the prophetess who can tell you the future, but she's doomed. No one can ever take her seriously. In that moment, she plays the Cassandra part brilliantly.
Although I think, John, I think Dumbledore does know what's coming. He's planned it all. That's what he intends to happen, and the reason he shoos her away is because he knows that that's what's going to happen. He said, I don't want to be warned about it, thank you very much, and I know this is coming. So it's a kind of clever double bluff on Rowling's part.
It could be, except for the tower. He doesn't know about the tower until he sees the death mark over the school when he gets back from his drinking date with Harry. Anyway. Point well taken, B, that maybe he knows and he doesn't want anybody else to know he's about to die. But the fact that she's telling him point blank, look at these cards, you're going off the tower tonight. And he gaffes her.
Well, and maybe, anyway. You know, it's not necessarily good to, you know when your own death's going to happen. He has to play out his part of the game. Whatever is going to happen, I can see that he might, you know, it might be some combination of, yeah, I know, and I don't need to know the details, thank you. So something like that to keep him focused on the things that he needs to do in that pivotal scene. Yeah, so I love that the lightning and tower imagery is so important there. So B, you actually have a theory about tarot cards and chocolate frog cards?
So this is from the History of Magic exhibition that I think has just finished in the US, but I hope will go on somewhere else. And in that exhibition, they've got the 18th century divination cards, which are probably the first set of playing cards specifically designed for cartomancy. So as John was telling us, tarot cards weren't used to foretell the future until 18th century. And these cards don't look like the tarot cards that we know now, and what they've got on them instead is images of wizards often. So they've got Merlin on them, Dr. Faustus, and Dr. D, for example. And I was thinking when I looked at them that this is where, you know, where do we with wizards on them in the series? We see them on chocolate frog cards. And the chocolate frog card that we read in the series is in the first one, and it does indeed tell us all about the future. It tells us all about what's going to happen. So obviously it tells us about Nicholas Flamel, so it tells us about what's going to happen in the Philosopher's Stone itself, but also by giving the date of Dumbledore's victory as 1945, it immediately links in with a much bigger schema than we'd expect. At that stage in a, you know, children's book that we're reading, we don't expect that the good and evil within this series should be linked at all with the Allies' defeat of Nazi Germany. But when you read that, and certainly when I first read that, I thought, oh, right, she's got bigger desires for how this is going to play out. So I thought that first chocolate frog card, by telling us about Nicholas Flamel directly, the 1945 date, possibly Dumbledore's discovery of seven uses of dragon's blood, I think that might have some deeper relevances as well, is actually acting like a cartomancy card, like a tarot card, and telling us about the future.
Cool. So the idea that it's connecting into this larger destiny or, you know, larger story that's being worked out. And of course, we've seen, I mean, it's predictive in a way, in the sense that we will later explore that period in the Fantastic Beasts series.
Yeah.
I'm still working the chocolate frog card out.
Exactly. That's still going.
Yeah, so it's so interesting to me, and you mentioned the History of Magic exhibition. Like, J.K. Rowling is really into this, you know, all of this stuff, the tarot, but also astrology. And I know, John, you have discovered some connections between J.K. Rowling and astrology. Where does her knowledge come from? What, you know, what's her background in that?
Well, this is a project in progress. We don't know for sure. We do know that in 2010, she said she did a lot of research into astrology for the Trelawney character. And then in 2012, in a New Yorker profile, we learned that she had done an astrological chart for some friends. But in 2015, we had the really remarkable event at our website run by Patricio Tarantino and company, the rollinglibrary.com. In April of 2015, they got a copy of that horoscope that she drew to include the illustration, the illustrated cover, and the complete text, which they've posted online. And this is mind-boggling. If you read the text, and I hope everybody will, I'm talking about it this week at Hogwarts Professor. What you find is that this is not a layman's knowledge of the text. I mean, I asked some astrologers in the UK what programs were available for her to cast this, and they said that if she had any access to the internet or computers in '94 when she did it, then there were things online already for that. It seems from her comments about computer, and I've corresponded with B about this, that that's unlikely that she did.
Because she doesn't seem very computer, like tech
no.
oriented.
No.
Yeah, she's probably getting books, right?
That's
where else?
Right.
What else?
And so she mentions 10 books inside the horoscope, and they range from medieval texts to kind of hilarious Trelawney type texts of the 20th century. But all of them, except for the Trelawney text, the Sacha Cohen text, are in a book called Just Astrology by McNeice. She just lifts the quotes out of McNeice's work to give herself a certain appearance of erudition. But here's the thing is her analysis is involved. It's funny and it's good. I mean, she really understands astrology in terms of aspects, conjunctions, the various houses, how they work together in terms of the elements. She even does comparative astrology. You know, how she does a comparison between the man and the woman to see if they're compatible romantically. You know, they're married with a child, but she says that they're...
So I hope her answer was, yes, you are compatible.
Yes, it was. I'm worried, though, because this thing was put up for sale, but and we have the man's and the child's, but not the woman's. I think she sold the other two, so I'm worried they got divorced. But anyway, the level of competence with the astrology is not something just from research for the Trelawney character, who's definitely Trelawney's an important character in the book, but she's definitely peripheral. The astrological research and facility is not professional. I wouldn't recommend that Rowling do this for a living, though she could. You know, she's very funny and not without insight.
And it's sort of charming. I mean, it's the art and the way that she phrases stuff. It's a charming little thing that she's put together.
Yeah, yeah. And this is evidence. This is the hard evidence that we didn't have, that she was into astrology. We actually have, you know, horoscopes that she cast and interpreted. And it's long. You're talking about, 11 pages of single-spaced text typed out. You know, this is not done on a computer. So, I mean, this is, you know, the evidence that we've been looking for. So now we've got the references inside the text, and we can say, oh, you know, Aaron Sweeney, who was the editor at Scribblist, the Leaky Cauldrons fan commentary page, wrote an essay about this for the first Harry Potter for Nerds collection, in which she tied it to alchemy, because alchemy and astrology really are tied at the hip, that all the metals, lead to gold, are like Saturn to the sun. Each one of them has an equivalent, and they're sort of inverse complements of each other. So, at least in medieval cosmology and sacred sciences. So, that Rowling would, writing an alchemical work, would write astrological works as well. Sweeney wrote that the books are all laid out. Every one of the books corresponds to one of the seven planets. I found that a real stretch, as much as I agree with her about her alchemical sourcings, and I admired how she laid it up with the Titus Burkhart collection. I just found it hard to believe at that point, but we didn't have this astrological chart. You know, we didn't have any of this evidence. Now, Evan Willis has done a lot of work with the mythology. It's interesting. One of her teachers at Y-Dean is a man named Steve Eddy. And he's famous for saying that he told her, stop writing about all this fantasy stuff, you know, get me some nitty gritty stuff. Things. But it's hard to believe that Steve Eddy told her that, because he was an expert in mythology and astrology. He's published works on those things. He's made his living as an astrologer. That he gives us an explanation that Rowling was fascinated by mythology and its relationship to astrology, that Evan Willis has brought out in his post at Hogwarts Professor about the hermetic background of the series. And that we've seen in everything from Cormoran Strike, the whole Castor and Pollux thing, to the Theseus elements inside the Fantastic Beasts story, that Rowling is writing mythological and classical tales wrapped into the astrological pieces. So I think we're really breaking some new ground here. And then this is the thing that last night that I posted at Hogwarts Professor, Will Sprague has written up about, he doesn't a totally different reading than Aaron Sweeney did, where he believes the planets line up, the books and the planets line up, but he only agrees with Aaron on two of the books and how they line up. And he gives a pretty good listing of evidence of, you know, why Philosopher's Stone is Mars, you know, the Quirinus Quirrell. For instance, you know, Mars Quirinus is one of the names of Mars. You know, it's fascinating stuff to see how all that lines up. It's really a whole new period. We're with this new documentary evidence that Rowling was a very serious student of astrology, and these new takes on the mythology and astrological symbolisms and retellings, reframing stories that she's doing. Yeah, we're looking at some exciting times in Harry Potter studies.
This is so interesting, and we can definitely see that there's, you know, there are still, it's not like you find that you find out about astrology and everything just falls into place, that there's still going to be interpretations at work. This is all really interesting to me, you know, with both tarot and astrology, because Trelawney, you know, is not like a character that we are going to have a lot of faith in in terms of what she's saying. And so how interesting that she, the person who's doing tarot and astrology and all of the all of those kinds of divination tools, is not given much authority or respect, is really a comical and pathetic character in some ways in the books. What do we think about the way she's characterized Trelawney? Let me just start with Eglantine. What do you think about Trelawney as the, you know, the voice of tarot, particularly in the series?
Well, I guess maybe Trelawney is kind of the representation of how we feel. You know, there's all that exciting world of tarot and divination and astrological predictions and everything, and we want to believe in them, but at the same time it's kind of like, maybe not. So maybe that's kind of the image of that person who knows about those occult things that we all want to believe in, but at the same time think is kind of cuckoo.
Yeah, and there's some ambivalence about it, and maybe J.K. Rowling also has some ambivalence about the, you know, these as tools for divination.
I should say more than some ambivalence. I think, you know, she said, I know a lot about foretelling the future without, I have to say, believing in it.
Yeah.
So I'm voice of skepticism here. She definitely doesn't believe in astrology or tarot or any of these things. She's using them as tools, as part of storytelling. And I think that skepticism we see very clearly in Lethal White, where there's this trifecta shop where they're selling all these kind of things.
Oh,
and
right.
It's really not a pretty picture that she's drawing of the kind of people who are interested. Now, I was quite interested by the negativity of that portrait in terms of the fact there clearly is an aspect of Harry Potter fandom which does believe in these things. And I felt she was very much distancing herself from that in Lethal White.
Yeah, but she's already, in a way, distanced herself from that with Trelawney, right? Although,
Trelawney is double, isn't it? So it's distancing.
Yeah.
Trelawney is an idiot. We've got McGonagall saying, you know, tripe, Sybil, which I love. but she's also, as the Harry Potter fandom has been keen to show, Trelawney's predictions are almost always right in lots of. So she's, I think, you know, she's having her cake and eating it. She's laughing at it as ridiculous, but then narratively it's fun to have them coming true, and it's fun as the readers try and work out how these predictions might come true. They're not always straight in the way they come true, but there might be sort of sideways on.
One of the funnier things, one of the most exciting things about Eglantine's paper was her mentioning of an aside, really, in a unauthorized biography of Rowling, in which one of her classmates in school said that she used to do tarot readings and palm readings to entertain her friends. And I'm beginning to think that Trelawney, that she was basically playing the Trelawney part for her friends, and she would play this new age thing. And it's definitely possible, especially in terms of what B is saying about it being used as a narrative thing, that Trelawney, because Trelawney is the vehicle through which we get the prophecy, which is real, right? I mean, this is that Trelawney is Rowling, is an embedded author inside the books. I mean, she exists inside Hogwarts, though she lives above it. She doesn't really come down very often into the thing, and she's held in kind of disdain by everybody inside the thing, the way they might treat J.K. Rowling writing this story about them. But here she is, this redheaded, eccentric person consumed by divinatory things, whose insights are the engine for the entire story. Without the prophecy, there really is no Harry Potter drama. That she's that vehicle almost makes her the author of the books.
John, I love this theory. This is
well,
how fun is this?
I wrote this up. This is that Hogwarts professor. Is Sybil Trelawney really J.K. Rowling, the case for an embedded author? This, you know, now that we know that she was the tarot reader, and we know that Trelawney, and this, my favorite thing here is Trelawney. When Rowling talks about Trelawney's name, she only talks about Sybil and why she gives it that funny spelling rather than the one like the real Sybil who could see the future. But she doesn't say anything about Trelawney other than to say this is a Scottish name. When Trelawney is the squire in Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. And if you've been to Edinburgh, you know that it's really the city of Robert Louis Stevenson. Now, maybe, you know, also Ian Rankin and J.K. Rowling, but all the statues are for Robert Louis Stevenson. She knows the relationship between her boy's adventure story and really the founding token of the genre. And Squire Trelawney inside the book, inside Treasure Island, is the character that funds the journey. It makes possible the whole adventure at Treasure Island, but he's an idiot. You know, he's a dupe. He hires a whole boatload of pirates to go to Treasure Island to dig up the treasure. He serves very much the same function that Trelawney does inside the books.
Making the plot, moving the plot, the engine of the plot.
That's right.
Oh, that's really neat.
And just thinking about the name Trelawney again, so she said it's a Cornish name, and she said, I love Cornish names, and I never got to use one before, so I thought, right, I'll have that for Trelawney. And then, of course, that comes out in Strike, with her love for Cornwall and names comes out fully as she gets into the Cormoran Strike novel. So she has definitely, it is a link between her Harry Potter work and her later work as well.
So, okay, we have Trelawney, who's doing a lot of divination, but then we also have Ferenczi, who comes in. We don't really hear a lot of things from Ferenczi, but he's a very serious character who is not easily made fun of. And I wonder if the one that she has to have giving us the prophecies, that she has to be kind of ludicrous so that we don't feel the entirety of the plot has automatically been revealed to us through prophecy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think this idea of amusement as well, so it's both that helps narratively kind of obfuscate that we've been told important things. Uh-huh. But as John has pointed out with the astrology charts that she casts, they're very funny. She talks about, you know, Pisces because he's going to drink like a fish and things like that. And the Eglantine quote about entertaining her friends with these palm, you know, I think they were meant to be serious palm readings. I'm sure they were funny palm readings, taking on the character of the person who she was doing it for. So I think having that, it's part of just another engine of humour within the works, which is a really important part of what she does, as well as you say, sort of hiding from us and where things are going. And of course, with the centaurs, we do get that the first time Harry goes into the Forbidden Forest in Philosopher's Stone, we have the centaurs basically telling us that he's going to die.
Well, and it's so Mars again, John.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mars is serious, the god of the forest. Yes, there he is.
We get a serious. So the centaurs, basically, only Ferenczi really tells us very much after that. He does a sort of, there's going to be war, you know, in a general sense, but I'm not really interested in the world of men kind of stuff. Hmm. But we do get a specific important prophecy at the beginning, but because we don't yet know the centaurs, I think most people will have forgotten that that happens, or certainly by the time they get to book seven, they've forgotten.
Something you were talking about, Katie, is that we have a prophecy and they take it very seriously, and yet what that means is there's another world, there's a dimension at least where there's some vision of the future possible in the present. You know, in effect, there's some space which is beyond just the present. Lauren Camacci, in her essay that's inside the world of Harry Potter that Christopher Bell edited last year, she wrote an essay called Frisky Risky Fire Whiskey, the rhetorical function of alcohol. And she talks about where Rowling plays, you know, she gives you an upfront message that basically, she does in terms of alcohol, but it's applicable here to this case, that she gives you an upfront message that prophecies and people that are into divination, it's all bosh. And yet, here we have this repeated message that, hey, this works. You know, we see that people are able to, you know, that these things happen. And B, I understand your rush to dismiss, but that's why you're here, B. You're here. Keep us all sober.
I mean,
that's
right.
I love it.
Rush to dismiss is quite fair, but I just think it's important. It'd be easy to listen to this conversation and think, oh, Rowling believes in tarot, or Rowling believes in divination, and we just, I think we have to take her own word and says, no, she doesn't.
We also know that Rowling is a liar. I mean, especially in terms, especially, well, let's be very clear that from 1999, really until 2005, maybe into 2007, she was involved in a war for her own legitimacy as a writer, that she was not someone who was writing a book that was the gateway to the occult. Uh-huh. If these astrological charts and comments about doing tarot readings and palm readings, as well as the alchemical stuff was denied by literary critics until 2007, when a 1998 interview came out. Rowling and her people stonewalled any conversation about this. And so when Rowling says, I don't believe in that stuff. And she just says, I do believe in God. That, I think, has to be taken in the context of the Potter panic that really dominated conversation in the public sphere about Harry Potter for a large part of the interlibrum years, while these books were coming out. I get it, B. She says, I don't believe in astrology. But she has inside her books astrological images and mythological references that suggest there's tremendous meaning and substance and heart inside these things. So I don't think she's talking about, full divinatory qualities, but she's saying there's something very, very real about these things. It's like the way she sneaks in all the things about the soul. I mean, here's a YA title that is giving a fairly traditional image of the soul inside these books, and nobody notices because it's part of the story. It's really contra Enlightenment theory about the soul doesn't really exist in post Enlightenment Europe and America. And Rowling introduces it inside this text. Really, she's taking a very much more otherworldly perspective, I think, after Nabokov, than we give her credit for. But by these superficial denials that she's not a practicing astrologer, doesn't believe in astrology. Those I think we can take as I don't want to get involved with defending myself as an occultist anymore.
One of the things I think that's at the heart of this that we're getting close to talking about, that was also in Lauren Kamaji's essay, is that role of free will. And Rowling has really stressed that the importance of free will is one of the themes that she thinks she was, trying to hit in the Harry Potter stories. And that it's not really that you have this prophecy destiny that you're just living out, but that it requires the exercise of free will. I'm interested in that, can you have prophecy and free will coexisting? Is she wrong about free will being the major theme? Is she, so good at building in the prophetic elements that that's really the message that comes through?
It seems to me that every time she offers a prophecy in the story, she also, there's also that element of someone acting upon it and making it come true. Like the prophecy about Harry being the chosen one, it was Voldemort's free will and his decision to go hit him that made it come true. And then every time there's this kind of prophecy, like we were talking earlier about Dumbledore deciding not to listen to Trelawney and not to know about what was going to happen at the top of the tower, and it was his choice, he decided to go with it. So I guess there's also always that kind of balance between the two.
I think that's the key word, Eglantine, is balance. That we read the books as postmoderns, and we have her witness that, yes, she is a postmodern, that it's all about free will. Speaking truth to power is the only way you can really actualize your existence. I mean, she's definitely, as a postmodern writer to a postmodern audience, she's hitting all the themes that we breathe in the air every day. But on the other hand, the balance is that this prophecy that was predicted, everybody walks in lockstep with it. They all choose to, actualize this prophecy, and it comes true. So this is why the ministry has an entire section in the Department of Mysteries devoted just to prophecies. They take it very seriously. That there's an access to the future inside some people, some seers, that other people don't have, and that these visions are real. Again, it's a balance. It's not just, hey, this has been predicted, therefore it will happen, but they do tend to come about. So this is, again, Lauren Kamaji's work. I really do recommend people pick up Inside the World of Harry Potter to read that essay. But I think it's important to see that she's not endorsing the occult arts, And yet, on the other hand, she's saying there is a dimension to reality beyond materialism and rationalism that is very real.
Yeah, I do think that's part of the role of all of those elements of the book is to, I mean, like what Bea was saying with the chocolate frog cart, it points you to a connection out and beyond the story. Eglantine, I was really interested in how you talked about not only, you know, like the times they're playing chess. I, of course, always think about Ron playing wizard chess, especially in the first book. But you also talk about it as a kind of metaphor that she's working through in the Harry Potter books themselves. Where do you see the chess images coming through? And how would you work out the parallels?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's obviously that referential game aspect of Ron playing giant wizard chess game and everything. But there's also, well, one interesting thing is that there is a mention of chess in at least once in every one of the books, even when it's a little hidden. For example, in the sixth book, it's hidden. The word chess does not appear, but she mentions the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Exchequer comes from the French word for chessboard. So there's definitely a mention of chess in every single book, whether they play it or they just randomly mention it when they talk about the shape of the Lovegood's house. And that element kind of hints at the fact that maybe chess is present on more levels than just the referential game part at the end of the first book. And there are elements that can make us think that the whole story kind of unfolds as a chess game between the black side and the white side.
If we're kind of working out that, you know, the two sides playing off against each other, I mean, I think a lot of people would see that kind of, you know, the black-white imagery. You have a theory about who are the kings who are playing and the sort of interesting and different role of the king in chess. The king is not the most powerful player on the board, I guess. Who do you think the kings are here in our overall chess game that's being played?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kings don't have the same role throughout the game either. There are different stages in the game of chess. There are three stages, actually. And in the first two stages, the king is kind of a weak piece. It has to be protected from attacks. But in the last stage of the game, the end game, the king becomes a very powerful, important piece, and it can get to the center of a chessboard and attack. And that's kind of what we see happening in the seven books.
So Harry must be one of the kings, right? He must be the white king.
Yes, absolutely. You would think possibly that maybe Dumbledore would be the white king because he has that sort of very important role. He's the leader and everything. But Harry would be the white king and Voldemort would be the black king, of course. And Dumbledore, interestingly, would just be a pawn, which is very interesting because one of the clues that kind of show that there might be a huge game of chess happening in the books is the scene in the memory where Dumbledore goes to meet Tom Riddle at the orphanage. And his character, and we have to remember that his first name is Albus, which means white, he steps onto a floor that is tiled in black and white. And the moment he goes to meet Tom Riddle is kind of the first step in that whole story where he tells Voldemort that he's a wizard, basically. So that's kind of the beginning of the chess game. And yes,
I love that imagery. That's really neat that he's literally stepping onto what amounts to a chessboard and meeting Tom Riddle for the first time.
Yeah. And it ends with the two kings fighting at the end, of course, Voldemort and Harry.
Dumbledore having sacrificed himself, maybe seeing himself as a piece that can be sacrificed by that point.
Just a pawn in the game.
Just a pawn in the game. Unless he's the player. Could he be the one who's set up all the strategy and put the pieces in motion? I don't know. But then he's gone by the end, so I don't know how far you can take that one.
Well, I don't know if he's gone. I don't know if he's gone, right? Oh. We get to meet him again, right?
King's Cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you talked about King's Cross Station, and the importance of the king imagery that's being used there as well in your conference paper.
Yeah, because that's where the Black King Voldemort and the White King Harry cross paths at the end of the game. So it does work with the name of that place that was chosen. Why else would they meet at King's Cross?
So, B, you also have some theories about chess in the Harry Potter series, but as it relates to early modern plays, what do you think is going on with J.K. Rowling's use of this particular game?
Chess has long been a really powerful metaphor in literature. And as John knows, one of the people who uses it most is Nabokov. And probably Nabokov gets his chess imagery in part because he's been translating Alice in Wonderland. And as you know, Through the Looking Glass is all a chess game that happens over the whole game. And Alice is really influential on Rowling as well. So it carries on into the modern time. But it's very important medieval literature, it's very important early modern plays. And as we know from Silkworm, with its extraordinary epigraphs, which are drawn from this astonishing range of early modern plays, Rowling does know her early modern theatre more than we might expect. The most famous use of a chess game in early modern theatre is in The Tempest, in Shakespeare's The Tempest, where the two lovers are discovered by Prospero playing chess together. And that feeds on a lot of chess imagery from medieval times, as well as in other early modern texts, of chess as a sort of metaphor for the erotic game between the sexes, where it was thought, for example, that men and women could play chess in medieval courtly circles in a way that a lot of other spheres were considered either female spheres or male spheres, and you weren't really meant to have a man and a woman on their own. Whereas chess was one place where you were, and so it got this undertow of a sort of sexual thing. So I'm really interested by the fact that Ron and Hermione play chess together in
Oh, yeah.
Harry Potter, yeah. So we see early on it's sort of the only thing that Hermione gets beaten at, and so Ron and Harry think she should play Ron a lot at chess because it's good for her to be beaten. So it's the only time really in Ron and Hermione's relationship, I think, where Ron gets the upper hand is on the chessboard, and to Hermione's credit, she does carry on playing with him. It happens again in Phoenix, where Hogwarts Express at the end, Harry and Ron are playing chess together, but what they're discussing is Ginny's love life, and a lot of things about the fact that Harry and Ginny will end up are discussed there. So there's a little moment, I don't know if you noticed it, but when Ron is pleased to hear that she's broken up with her current boyfriend and says, "Well, I hope you'll choose better next time," and he gives Harry a little furtive look. And I think, if Harry had been paying proper attention there, he would have known that actually Ron will be okay with him and Ginny going out later. And then Ginny says, she's dating another person, and Ron's so outraged he throws the board over. He can't cope with it at all. So that sort of sense of romantic stories circulating round chessboards, I think, is again something she's got from earlier literature.
That's really cool. I love that. And that Ron is good at chess. So that's one of the things that I confess to being frustrated about in the resolution of the story arc, because I thought, Ron is good at wizard chess. We see, his understanding of strategy and moves and his willingness to sacrifice himself even, but also important. And we see that in book one, and I really thought at the end we would see more of him being a chess strategist. But I love that maybe it's really, if we think about Ron and chess, that there's maybe a more romantic element and
Yeah, that's right. So him getting the girl in the end is his version of getting good at chess. Yeah, I like that too, as a sort of, because I agree with you, I felt the same. It's one of those things where you thought it was going to get tied up in it and it didn't. But yeah, he does get romantic success finally in the final book. So maybe that's the winning the chess game.
Well, one of the things I think, Eglantine, that you had mentioned was that you were sort of interested in all the games and the game motifs. She's building in lots of games, including Quidditch, but also wordplay. And I think we could think of tarot and astrology. She seems to be doing them in a way that they're like games, entertainment. Are there other kinds of games that we think are important, and why do we think she is so, why is she so playful?
Well, there's the major game in the books that she plays with her readers. She's always playing with us, kind of giving clues, giving hints, and just, you know, teasing. So that's definitely a game that's present throughout the series.
I do think that's one of the things people find really delightful about the books, mm-hmm. that back and
yeah,
forth.
Yeah, so that's what gets you coming back to the books and reading them again to pick up the things that you missed the first time, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it makes them rereadable, which is mm-hmm. so important. I actually literally was just talking with my middle schooler son, who was saying, why do we always have to reread the book? I've already read it. I don't need to go back through it. And I said, you reread Harry Potter. Didn't you see new things in there? And I got the, you know, I got the sort of stony look. You know, that means I'm right, but he can't say it. You know? So I was like, oh, score. But she does teach you the value of rereading just through that playfulness and the...
Harry Potter, teaching valuable life lessons.
Yeah, this is really a book for rereaders, not for readers. And again, to keep sounding my Nabokov horn, I mean, Nabokov made his living... creating crossword puzzles and chess problems for German newspapers for a period of his life. I mean, that and everything that he wrote was considered to be a challenge to his reader to figure out what he was doing and saying. So people are still fighting today about who the real narrator of Pale Fire, probably his greatest book, is. And it's a live game, you know, 50 years on. Rowling's work, here we are, it's more than 20 years, right? It's 10 years since the last book came out, and we're really just beginning to talk about the prophecy in its proper context in terms of these occult arts. I mean, this is exactly that kind of work where it rewards the teasing out of its meanings. She's exactly that kind of playful writer that's created a puzzle that we have to figure out. As you say, that's one of the great pleasures of the story, is it rewards reinvestigation and probing. I should say, because B is in the room, this is also a pointer to one of her other favorite authors, Jane Austen, and how Jane Austen rewards closer reading. And this in B's really brilliant and seminal literary allusion to Harry Potter, those chapters make this point better than I ever could.
I completely agree, obviously, that Austen is one of her sources for this. And I've listened to Jane Austen's novels on loop since, I don't know, for the last 20 years or so. And I feel she's the only author I know who is quite, you can just keep on listening to them and they keep on giving you more. And I think she's absolutely, and Rowling was consciously echoing that in her own style.
Well, I mean, the joke, C.S. Lewis said that the only fault, there are two faults with Jane Austen as a novelist, and that is that her novels are too few and too short. And he reread, he supposedly reread Austen's complete works every year from the age of 16 until his death. That's the kind of rereading that Harry Potter fans do and the Nabokov people do from the Nabokov. I mean, it's that kind of teasing and playing and the reward of that embedded text. It's a great game. It's a great game.
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that we can see her doing really, I think, in all of the works that she's creating. And it, just to draw us back specifically to chess, tarot, astrology, you know, where do we see those coming through in, like, the Cormoran Strike series? We've talked a little bit about that, but also Fantastic Beasts.
I suppose we could just argue that writing a detective series is kind of bringing that, the gamification of Harry Potter up to a different level. So there aren't,
sure,
I think, that many games in Cormoran Strike. It's not playful in the way that Harry Potter is, but it obviously the question of what you're trying to work out is much clearer, much more the genre surface with that.
Yeah, and I think you're right that there's some of the playful elements are maybe not as clear, and yet somehow some of the, you know, the mythic stories that she seems to be drawing on for Cormoran Strike as John has talked about, it does tend to play into that idea that maybe there is some kind of larger destiny that we're seeing work out over the story arc.
I agree, of course, that as different as the genres are, and as much as B has just said, the detective genre makes more obvious, you know, the fact we have a puzzle here to figure out, and we're trying to figure it out just ahead of the detective and always fail because the story is well told. In the background are these, in the series, are the playful things, all the references to the previous books, how they relate to one another. This is Rowling doing her slow narrative release, alchemical, mythological magic. No wands, but the same kind of reward for rereadings. If you reread Cuckoo's Calling after you've read Lethal White, you wind up just laughing. There are so many references to Cuckoo's Calling inside Lethal White that we've reached the story turn. We know this is like, you know, Goblet is the Philosopher's Stone in Deathly Hallows.
Is there a Wheel of Fortune moment, though?
Yeah,
I wonder.
I have to go back and look, right? I wish there were a tarot card that had the swans in it. You know, that would be a big help. But you don't, because the swans are a big part of Lethal White. As well as the white horse. Are there any white horses in the tarot cards? I mean, we have to go back and check that out. No, it's the Castor and Pollux mythological and astrological references really permeate those books and show that Rowling is working the same story. And the complementary antagonistic relationship of recovery that Cormoran and Robin are leading are also an alchemical experience. She's doing the same thing, and it rewards it. Except for the fact that it's not as superficially magical. I think these books are really Rowling's best work. I'm obviously taking a minority position there, but it's the story. I guess maybe it's just because I'm a fan of detective stories too. It's a real delight to read these things because it's a puzzle again, and we're on the hunt. It's wonderful to have a second chance at Rowling doing her thing.
And I think there has to be some of this also in the Fantastic Beasts series. If any of our listeners want to try to find some, you know, ways that this, you know, the occult and divination and tarot might be appearing in Fantastic Beasts, I think that would be, we would love to hear about that.
Well, we do have the prophecy that's revealed in the second movie. So again, we're getting that dimension of this book that sometimes the readers, we only get it in the written screenplay, but almost everybody seems to be referring to a specific prophecy, trying to figure out what's going on with this prophecy.
Yeah, that's right. It's that book that they have in this one.
That introduces that dimension, that, you know, otherworldly dimension to the story. That they feel that there's some sort of track that people are following that previous people, however poetically, may have expressed and understood better than we do today. And so they spend their time trying to dope this out. It's a large part of Grindelwald's manipulation of the narrative is to take that story and bend it to his own purposes. So that's part of the puzzle we have to figure out is how much of this is the prophecy, how much of this is Dumbledore and Grindelwald's back and forth machinations to get people to believe what they want them to believe.
And I'm going to, you know, making a prophecy for the next. I expect that this will prove to be something that comes true in despite of Grindelwald. So everyone's misreading it at the moment, and we're going to find out that the true reading will come true. That's my guess.
Boy, B, going right out on an edge there.
Yeah, going wild.
With all of Western literature. Wow, there's a daring
she does love the misdirection. And, you know, I was just thinking about it through our conversation here. You know, I also do not believe in astrology or tarot or fortune telling. However, I do like to check my horoscope. There are probably people out there who feel the same way. I like to look at it, and even when I don't really believe it, and the times when I'm most interested in it are the times when I have the most uncertainty in my life. Something big might be, you know, on the cusp of happening. I'm not sure what the future is going to hold. And so I'm really interested by what you said about Fantastic Beasts in particular, because it strikes me that these are, all of these people are, they're, you know, they're, in a way, they're trying to game the game by reading the instructions or reading the end game that might be revealed in a prophecy. But when you're in it, you can't really see how that might legitimately play out. And so the desire to have a prophecy, the desire to be able to see the future, is something that's very, you know, very human and relatable. But then what that actually works out to be is impossible to see in your own individual complex situation.
That's brilliant, Katie, really, because what you see, consequently, is Dumbledore and Grindelwald, the real storytellers inside Fantastic Beasts, trying to control the public narrative and spin it to their direction, to their advantage, so people will follow them, or at least not follow Grindelwald. That is their awareness that people need these stories, and so they each try to manipulate this. They're both very aware of the public prophetic narrative, and they want to spin it the way they want to. This is Rowling's actually much more profound commentary on fake news, is that they're basically, you know, people throwing up the shadows on the cave wall, and they know how that works. And you need to be aware of you know, these prophetic things may work out, these public narratives, but it's not what you think. It's not as straightforward as somebody saw this and this is how it turns out.
That's a commentary on the whole of the human condition, ultimately, which is why we love J.K. Rowling so much and why we can continue talking about her so much. Well, we are out of time. We're actually a little far out of time. So, Eglantine, let me ask you just this last question. We've been so delighted to have you on today. What's Thank next you. For you in your examination of Harry Potter as serious literature?
So the next step for me is I'm starting a PhD right now here in Paris, and I'll be working on the words created for Harry Potter and the process from their creation to their reception and the adaptation and how all of that, like what kind of effect all of that had on the readers. And yeah, I'm very excited to begin that. I'm currently stalled a bit because I'm looking for a co-tutelle to make it happen. But yeah, as soon as that's worked out.
So you're looking for, I think you were telling me that you need like an outside reader on your dissertation committee.
Yes, so I'm looking for a co-supervisor for my PhD, and once that happens, I'm really looking forward to doing that research.
Yeah, I think that's great, and especially as John said, looking at you know, the story in translation is fascinating, but especially when you look at it with the French, since French is, you know, J.K. Rowling's, you know, major second language, and she's obviously building so many French things into the stories themselves. So that sounds really fruitful.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, thank you again so much, Eglantine, for joining us.
Thank you.
With your very interesting read on both tarot and chess. And I loved how we got to talk about, in general, also the playfulness and the, you know, but also those larger questions of, you know, who's playing the game and the degree to which we as players might have control over that game. We have been able to explore that very well. And thank you too, Beatrice Groves, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Katie.
And I think both of you have really helped us to tap into, I would say, both the prophetic and the playful elements of the Harry Potter books. I've had a good divination class. it's been good.
I've been Hermione storming off, haven't I?
I think you served that role here. That's great.
That's wonderful. Anytime you can compare yourself always to Hermione is a win, B. And thank you, John, for being our expert guest, sharing with us your insights, especially on Rowling's astrology interests.
Boy, Eglantine has inspired me. We're doing a whole series a post on these subjects at Harvard's Professor, and I hope people will join us over there for that conversation.
Wonderful. So there's even more to be uncovered here. I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you, Emma. We so appreciate you. You make us sound really good. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and our producers there at MuggleNet, Lori Beckoff and Ruchi Akula. Now, speaking of which, dear listeners, we are glad you joined us today, too, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or a question for us. You can share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And now I will leave you all with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.